So let's talk first about the TEFTA article. So what's the take-home message?
Be careful what you grab.
Take Brett Shelton's class every spring. The data visualization class he teaches.
Is it a good one?
It's a phenomenal class. He uses a lot of the stuff that Dr. Tuff, that Tuff teaches, and it's really good. And it's one of those classes I'm like, everybody should take it, because you spend a whole semester long learning how to apply the principles that are talked about in here. And Brett's very, very good at it.
Oh, and it's on OpenCourseWare.
And it's on OpenCourseWare too, if you'd like to learn the information without taking the class. Data visualization, and it's under the instructional technology section of courses.
OCW.usu.edu. By the way, I will get our videos all updated on that page. Sorry, I've just been emailing you direct links up till now, just because we just got that all upgraded, and so this week I can finally add all of that.
Can you email those links to the other course too?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Sure.
Okay. So you don't have to look.
Okay. So a take-home message is to take his class, but
his
in
class.
Case you don't, you don't do that.
Well, I guess one thing I learned is that it's really important how you choose to aggregate your data. So that the more disaggregated, the better, but I guess not always.
Yeah,
that
see, would the rest of you agree with that, that the more disaggregated, the better?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I would say that the first part of your statement, I think, is absolutely correct, that it's really important how you aggregate your data.
Yes.
But you can obscure as much by
disaggregating.
Yeah, by having it too disaggregated.
Too
So what is the parallel with what you're doing right now? I mean, you're collecting a lot of information from individual studies, I hope, to support the premises in your problem statement. So at its greatest level of disaggregation is just the studies themselves. And yet, that's not a very effective review. And so you have to aggregate it at some level. But if you aggregate it too much, then it's not very useful either.
Right, that's what we were just talking about. It's funny, I was showing in my table, and I have like 15 effect sizes per study. And you know, it's Jared, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was talking to Jared, and I was like, what am I gonna do with all these effect sizes? And at first, I averaged every one of the effect sizes and just got one average. But you know, with his brilliant mind, he said, well, why don't you see if you can maybe chunk that a little bit better? And I easily could, I just hadn't thought about it, where I can look at sort of the macro structure of a narrative and the microstructure, and then get an average effect size of each one of those. And so I think that hopefully that's going to be the right balance for my presentation, but it's going to be a lot better than so many effect sizes that you just can't make sense of. There'd be way too many.
Right. And I mean, people would like to have a rule, you know, well, you should always average if you have more than X number of effect sizes or whatever, but it just doesn't work. I mean, you have to apply common sense to say, what are the questions I'm trying to answer? What are the subgroups in this particular data set? I mean, maybe it makes sense to combine all the studies that were done before 1990 versus those done after 1990. Maybe it doesn't. It depends on a lot of things that you can't reduce to a rule. But how you aggregate data is very important. Okay, what else?
How you display it is very important.
Okay.
As you saw in the Hellering thing and answering the question that you're asked, I was floored that out of 13 charts, 6 of them didn't have any data on O-rings or on rocket temperature at all.
Okay.
And
but maybe that's because they didn't yet know what question they were asking. Too. I mean, perhaps.
Right.
But
that it makes a point, because right. I've seen some graphs and tables that weren't even close to answering questions that I was looking at. They were just pretty pictures.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. So how you aggregate the data, how you display the data. What else?
I thought on page 31 that their pullout quote that they have there about visual representations of evidence. It says that they should be governed by principles of reasoning about quantitative evidence, and for information displays, design reasoning must correspond with scientific reasoning, that clear and precise seeing becomes as one with clear and precise thinking. I thought that was probably the most important point of this whole article, is that what you're going to be putting out there should reflect what the scientific reasoning is. And if your scientific reasoning is clear, hopefully your data visualization methods will be as clear as well.
Okay.
And sometimes flaws in the visualization can reveal flaws in the reasoning mm-hmm. behind the conclusions you're drawing.
Okay. Now let's take that a step further. One of the other things that they say somewhere in here is that the conclusion from a well-drawn data presentation leaps off the page. It jumps out and grabs you. Okay. But you can have data that is based on flawed reasoning also jump out and grab you. So you certainly want it to be a presentation that makes it obvious to the reader the point you're trying to make. But for you to be successful, you need to make sure it's based on sound reasoning. Okay. So someone once said, I don't think it's in this article, that tables are not warehouses for storing data. But yet we often treat them that way, which is what Doug may have been doing earlier, to say, well, I've got all the data there. But to do it well, it's not a warehouse, it's a way of presenting information to the reader that guides them to the conclusion you want them to reach, but then you have an obligation as a scientist to make sure they're reaching the conclusion which is supported by the evidence. You know, it's not just trying to get them to conclude what you want them to conclude. Okay, what else? Okay, let's talk about the specifics for a few minutes. So let's take Snow's analysis first. Right at the beginning, the second paragraph, it says, by creating statistical graphics that revealed the data, Dr. John Snow was able to discover the cause of the epidemic and bring it to an end.
What page?
Page 5.
Second paragraph in the article. So what's wrong with that sentence? What's wrong with that sentence?
Oh, you mean the second sentence, okay.
Second paragraph, and it's the second after a long run-on sentence. By creating statistical graphics that reveal the data, Dr. John Snow was able to discover the cause of the epidemic and bring it to an end.
It doesn't look like you brought it to an end.
Okay, did removing the pump handle bring it to an end?
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, it was already tapering off pretty rapidly, partly because they'd run out of people to die, okay? So even here there's some flawed reason. Now he brings it back later, but the reason I point that out is, I mean, here's a person who's making the point about having correct reasoning,
yeah.
And it's so easy to not do that, I mean, to fall into that trap, okay? On page 7 and 8, he lays out three criteria for what constitutes a good presentation of data. He said, second paragraph down, starting with why, he said you have to have a good idea, and then he goes on down further and talks about having good timing, and then the third point is having good method. Okay. So how does all that apply to what you're doing? I mean, you have data from lots of different studies or lots of different sources of evidence, and you're trying to put that together into a convincing argument. How is knowing about Jon Snow going to help you do that? And how similar is your data to Snow's data?
Well, I think the idea with Jon Snow is that there was a lot of sound reasoning behind it. I guess he had a good idea. And I think a good idea can be presented poorly and can be presented at the wrong time. Or you can have any combination of those three variables, but he had all three of those variables going for him.
Okay. So he had a good idea, and then he used his data to test that idea. Okay. So he looked at all the people who died of cholera, but then what did he do next?
Charted it.
Yeah, he charted it. I didn't pose the question. So he looked at all those people who lived in the area of Broad Street and said, wow, look at all the people who are dying of cholera here. And how does that compare to the normal rate of cholera deaths in London? And said, wow, it's so much higher. But then he said, wait a minute, there are people who are dying of an unreasonable and unexpected rate of cholera who didn't live around Broad Street. And so we went after those counter examples to say, is there any connection? And I don't even know whether, when he started looking at it, whether he was trying to find a connection to Broad Street or whether that just came out of the data later. But I think that's real relevant to what you're doing with your data. So you've got a hypothesis that says if you teach children who have English as a second language, if you try and teach them how to read in this way, you get better results. And you went into your review thinking that. But as you begin to analyze those data, you'll find some exceptions, I suspect. Okay? And it's just as important to examine those exceptions in your review of literature as it was for Snow to examine his exceptions here. To say, well, wait, they got really good results and they didn't do these same things. Why is that? And part of the scientific process is to be able to look at not only the evidence which is consistent with your hypothesis, but the evidence which is inconsistent, and to try and figure out why that's happening. Is it, were their studies not designed as well? Were there other historical threats to validity going on? Might there be two avenues to reach the same goal? I mean, you started off with, all of you started off with a set of premises that lead to the conclusion this study needs to be conducted. But if you're really looking at your data carefully, the way this article suggests you should, you may adjust that as you do it. You may reach a different jumping off point. And that'll be a much stronger study if you do that. Let me show you a somewhat different example. So many of you will have premises in your problem statement that can't be reduced to a standardized mean difference effect size. But the same sorts of principles that we're talking about here still apply. So this is just slides from a PowerPoint presentation about a study we did a number of years ago. But here's the essence of the problem statement. Okay? One, newborn hearing screening has expanded dramatically during the last 10 years, and now more than 95% of all babies are being screened for hearing before they leave the hospital. Two, many people are concerned that hearing screening of newborns might cause undue parental anxiety, worry, or disruption of maternal-child bonding. Three, these concerns are based on opinions of prominent people, evidence that other types of newborn hearing screening causes undue anxiety and worry, and some limited research on newborn hearing screening. Four, unfortunately, the research on newborn hearing screening that has examined parental anxiety doesn't give us a definitive answer because, number one, there isn't much of it. Number two, what does exist defines worry and anxiety very narrowly, doesn't look at long-term outcomes in many cases, and doesn't ever compare how much people worry about newborn hearing screening with other things such as how the baby sleeps and eats and behaves, so you have a context. Five, therefore we need to do a study to evaluate how much parental anxiety there is. Now, we've got a problem statement. The next task is to assemble the evidence to support each of the premises in that problem statement. If you look at the kinds of research that's out there, it was impossible to compute a standardized mean difference effect size, okay? Because you had very different ways of measuring anxiety. You had completely different instruments that were usually reduced to X percent of the parents were worried. Or X percent of the parents had anxiety, or some score on like the parenting stress index. The comparison groups for the 6 or 7 or 8 studies that existed were all different. Sometimes they compared them to people who passed the hearing screening. Sometimes they didn't compare them at all. It was just a number said that 14% of people are worried about this. So you really couldn't reduce them in the way that some of the things you've read so far enabled you to say, well, the average effect size is so-and-so. But you still need to present the data in a way that makes that case. Okay, and so what these slides do is just looking at points 2 and 3 of this problem statement, but it says, here are the 3 reasons that people are concerned about, or people believe that there might be anxiety associated with newborn hearing screening. And then it says, first, look at what famous people are saying about this. And there aren't many famous people. There's actually only 3 famous people, but they're very famous. And so people said, wow, that's a type of evidence that we ought to pay attention to. Now, these people were all making this case without a stick of evidence. I mean, it was just their opinion. But opinion can be important, okay? And so in your prosecuting attorney's role, you say, I think this is a problem because every famous person who's talked about this says it, and your effect size just becomes their statement. Okay, now it won't always be that way, but I'm just encouraging you to think broadly about what an effect size is. Okay. Then, the next set of slides is looking at what people have found when they looked at other newborn conditions for which we screen other than hearing loss. Okay, and so there are 6 studies, which was all the studies we could find, by the way, and the effect size is in the right-hand column there, and some of them are pretty shaky, like the Rothenberg and Sill study done in 1968, which everybody in this literature cites. The closest they came to quantitative data was many cases with anxiety syndrome, you know? And that's all there was, okay, yeah, okay. Now, but if you look at the other numbers there, I mean, you can see concern or reason to be concerned. You know, 48 to 76% of parents reported confusion, shock, or anger. 61% were severely affected, whatever that means. I mean, now you'd almost have to go back and read the article to tell. So the point I'm making here is this wasn't very clean data. But you still have an obligation to say, based on everything I've read, here's how I would portray that data to convince the reader that this is an area where I should be concerned. Then if you flip to the next page, these are the studies that have looked at newborn hearing screening. There are a few more of those. You see much lower numbers. I mean, that's what jumps off the page at you, is on the previous page, you were looking at numbers in the 40, 50, 60, 70% range. Now you're looking at numbers in the 2, 4, 15, 20s, but not nearly as high, okay? Now, I'm not saying this is the only way to present this data, but I'm just trying to broaden your thinking, because I'm sure some of you are beginning to struggle with saying, well, how am I going to portray that data? I've read these 17 articles, and it doesn't fit into a standardized mean difference effect size. And sometimes it won't, okay? Okay, now, let's shift gears again. We're going to come back to the Tuft article in a moment. But, okay, this is from an article written by a guy named Howard Wehner. Also does a lot of work on graphical analysis. Okay, so he takes this example from a test item on a National Assessment of Educational Progress test. And the question is, in the year 2000, which energy source is predicted to supply less power than coal?
What grade level is this for?
I think, I don't remember for sure, I think it's 8th grade, as I recall. Okay, you got it? All the data's right there. Now, here's the very same data taken from that graph. Okay, and so the question is, In the year 2000, which energy source is predicted to supply less power than coal? Hydropower.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, it's pretty clear, okay? You could probably have a third grader answer it now.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's the very same data as is here. And I mean, this is from, you know, the U.S. Department of Interior. You know, pretty smart people put together this graph. Okay, so the take-home message is not just that you need to figure out what's going on. I mean, the person who made this graph knew what the answer was, okay? And yet they portrayed it in a way that was very difficult for the reader to extract that information. And so your job, as you've got these five or six premises that you're providing evidence for, and your conclusion is that this premise can be supported and justified and defended. You need to make sure that you present that information in your paper so that it looks more like this than like this. Okay? Do another example here. Let's see if this is, yeah, okay. I'm worried that might not come off. Okay, so this is expenditures on education versus SAT scores, Scholastic Aptitude Test scores. And you see over on this side, the expenditures in, I don't know, it's probably millions of dollars. I'm not sure what it is, tell you the truth.
Per pupil.
Oh, it's yeah. It's per pupil expenditures, okay? And then on the other side are SAT scores. Okay. So what do you get from looking at that graph?
They're spending more money, but they're not getting more results.
Yeah. Okay? Pretty clear from that graph, isn't it? Okay. Now let's take the same data and the same dual axis presentation, but we'll just make it on a different metric. Okay, so the SAT scores are the filled-in dots now, are the dark dots, and the per pupil expenditures are the open dots. What's the message from this graph? We're spending a little bit more, and SAT scores have gone off the charts. Okay, so it's exactly the same data. Okay, what's the take-home message for what you're doing in trying to put these papers together right now?
I'm just trying to see the differences there and the difference in the data. Oh, plot the X and Y Z. X and Y Z.
Yeah, but they also put it on a completely different metric.
Yeah.
See, 800, 900, 1,000. Here, it goes from 800 to 900.
Yeah.
So the top to the bottom here goes from 800 to 1200. Here the top to the bottom goes from 800 to 900.
Okay.
Similarly, the one over here goes from 0 to 20,000, whereas the one over here goes from 2800 to 4800.
Jeez.
Okay. So it's just changing the scales dramatically. Okay, so the take-home message for what you're doing?
Well, I don't try to be manipulative.
Okay.
Present as accurate picture as you.
So it comes back to what Melissa was saying earlier about having good science underlying your data. So part of the message is to present your data in a way that leaps off the page at the person. But the other part of it is that can be abused pretty easily, okay? I mean, your job isn't to convince me that what you believe is true, unless it really is. And this is where there is an intersection between science and advocacy. A good scientist, I'm convinced, is also a good advocate, okay? That once you figure out what the science is telling you, I think you've got an obligation to try and convince other people of that. Okay. But you can also abuse that. that you can say, well, I just know this is right. I don't have to have any data to support it, but I really feel in my heart that this is the right way to go. And so then you present data in a way that makes it look like it's the right way to go. Okay? So those people who voted to launch the Challenger, you know, I mean, they didn't think it was going to have the outcome that it did. So, okay, now. So here's a table of data. Deaths due to unexpected events by type of event. Okay? Spend a minute or two digesting that information. In the next three or four overheads I'm going to show, I'm not going to change any of the data, but just like we have in any others. Okay, what jumps off the page?
Besides another cause, maybe the smallest.
Okay.
You're gonna get killed in the United States, homicide, over all the other possibilities, or all the other countries there.
Okay. Okay, so look at that one for a minute. Now, look at this one. Okay, it's the same data. What's been done differently?
Rounding.
Okay. And so, does it really matter to you that it was 1,277.2 deaths? Okay.
Well, the death due to all causes is an automatic.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Which I think that information is kind of necessary to understand the total unexpected deaths. I mean,
okay.
Because isn't it like a percentage related to how many deaths are happening that are really unexpected versus
possibly? So that's a good point. I mean, there it depends partly on the message you're trying to give.
But I can see how some of that information in the first graph that you showed in that one is how do you say it?
Superfluous.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and does it matter? I mean, it's got the year in which the data came from.
But they're not all the same year.
They're not all the same year, but it depends on the message you're trying to communicate. Those were the years in which data were available. They're all pretty close. They're all either 74, 75, or 76, right? Yeah. And so I think the person who was doing this graph was convinced, or this table, was convinced that year didn't really make any difference. It's just to be complete. So again, he was using the table more as a warehouse. Okay. Now the deaths due to all causes might be important, but as we go on here.
Walter, I do have a question before you flip that. What's the difference between deaths due to all causes and total?
The total is deaths due to unexpected events.
Yeah.
And the other one is deaths due to all causes.
It's everybody who died, so like in Austria,
for every 100,000. Natural causes, there were 127,000 plus the unexpected. But then there was a total that was unexpected. Okay, now I got it.
Okay. Rachel's point is a good point. It depends on what information you're trying to present here.
Yeah.
Although, if the ratio of unexpected events to all causes is important, probably a better way to point it out, like some sort of a percentage or a, you know, because right now I have to divide it, okay, in my head, and I'm not very good at that. Okay, so in this one, they've taken away a lot of data that was presumably extraneous, superfluous. Okay, they've also rounded a lot. Okay.
They also changed the ordering of the country. Everyone was alphabetical.
Oh, yeah.
And so it made it difficult to compare, okay, so what's the most dangerous place to live in as opposed to the safest? Whereas this chart, you can see right there that France has, you know, 78 unexpected deaths. And while, you know, there's only one homicide, there's 21 from other causes, you know. What's causing it? Are they choking on their cheese and wine? Or, you know, is that what's making it a dangerous place? So it gives you a little bit better of an ability to compare. If you look at Japan, and there's only 31 unexpected deaths per 100,000 people. So, you know, if I'm going to pick a country to go live in that's safer for unexpected deaths, then maybe I'll go live in Japan. But
okay, good. Yeah, I mean, this... So they've rounded it so it's easier to process, and they've ordered it. There's nothing that says the previous table was ordered alphabetically. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with doing that, but again, you should look at the data and say, how am I going to present the information in a way that the reader can grasp it easiest? And ordering it by the frequency of unexpected deaths seems like a more logical way to do it. Again, depending on the message we're trying to portray. What else jumps off the page? France is the most dangerous, Japan's the least dangerous. The point Doug made before, he picked it out of the other one, but you weren't supposed to, Doug. Way to go. But it really stands out here, partly because it's a two-digit number instead of a one-digit number. The other one that stands out is the one that Melinda mentioned about France. Okay. So there are outliers that show up.
Wonder what they defined as other causes.
Say on the other chart, the first one.
Fire, death by firearm. France wasn't at war in 1974, right?
I don't think so.
Well, accidents caused by firearms or injuries, injuries of undetermined causes, and all other accidental causes.
We were out of Vietnam by 75.
I think maybe just barely,
UK that was at war. Falkland Islands.
Yeah, I was going to say, it wasn't much of a war.
It could just be very clumsy people with guns.
I still think it's the cheese. Yeah. I don't know.
It might be the cheese. I think that classifies as clumsy.
Okay, now, this chart adds a little more information. Adds the median at the bottom.
Ah, that's nice.
Okay. So it gives you a point of reference a bit more. Okay.
To know where the modes are.
So, I mean, you knew before that the U.S. homicide rate was way out of whack.
Right. Yeah,
now you see that it's
really
out of whack. Okay.
It's below average with natural factors.
Yeah.
And
the transport accident.
I can see any others. Sorry.
Oh, no, it's not the transport accident. It's just barely.
And that they must have really dangerous roads in Austria to have such a high transport accidents.
Actually,
it's either that or the Autobahn. And
it's probably the Autobahn. Mostly it's foreigners driving on the Autobahn.
I really would like to see information about population density.
Oh, okay.
And that I really am suspicious that most of those homicides don't happen in Logan, Utah.
Well, but this is rate per thousand.
100,000.
So
yeah.
It's been adjusted, But that doesn't mean that your idea isn't an important idea, because maybe it's when you put too many people living in close quarters that they kill each other. Okay.
Then they'd be up in Japan because they got lots of people living in Japan in very close quarters.
Probably.
That's where everybody gets a
little
fuzzy.
Well, no. I mean, see, this is
depending on the questions you're asking.
This goes back to Jon Snow now. It's having a good idea. Exploring that idea with both cases which are consistent and which are counter, and seeing what comes out of it, okay? And see, that's the point that hopefully you're all at now. You've collected all of your data, you're done reading articles, and now you're thinking about this data and saying, what does this tell me about the question that led me here in the first place? And the real problem, in my opinion, about quote-unquote meta-analysis is that it leads people to stop thinking if you're not careful. that you say, oh, I can do all of this just by computing means and standard deviations and correlations, you know, that it there's a tendency to engage in mindless number crunching when you have the data in that format. It should be just the opposite. It should open up whole new opportunities to think about the data and to ask the kind of questions that Doug was just asking. You know, saying, oh, what if this is related to density? It's not the issue of rate per 100,000, because that's taken care of, but density might do it. What else might do it? Why might there be more homicides in the U.S. besides that we're angry people?
We have access to better weaponry.
Access to weapons? Yeah.
Could also have, I don't know if it's so much of an issue here since most of those, none of those are third world countries, but I guess how they were doing financially that year would make a difference.
So let's explore those two issues and then we'll come back to Melinda. Access to weapons. So how might you explore that hypothesis for a moment? You couldn't do it with just this data. You'd have to gather some more data.
Yeah.
But you could clump those 20 countries or whatever they are into easy access to guns, limited access to guns, no access to guns. See what happens. And if you found, for example, that Belgium and France and Austria all had some access and everyone else had no access, then you'd say, wow, maybe that's something here. Be surprised if that's the case. I think Austria and Germany are pretty similar on that, but I don't know. So, okay. What was the other point that someone made?
The amount of money per person.
Yeah. So the.
Because it could have been a recession.
So the economies in these various countries. Yeah.
And that the political situation involved in that area dealing with the money. If you have little resources, you're more likely to kill your neighbor to get food than you are to.
Okay.
And you don't have any commentary on your cultural. Make up those countries, either.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. That's a great point. The ethnicity, the mix of cultures.
Oh, that is an interesting point.
Right.
Now, so far, we're only focusing on homicides. I mean, there are some other industrial accidents range from 1 to 4, so they're 4 times as high in Austria.
Well, 2 times as high, right? Because the median would be 2. So.
No, but there's still 4 times in Austria as in France.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But it's double, yeah. And like transport accidents is much higher in Austria, but it's, well, it is 3 times as high as the low, right?
Mm-hmm. Do they classify bicycles?
I don't know, probably. But
because that would make a difference in places like China and Japan.
Actually, it makes a difference in almost every country but the U.S. I mean, there's a lot more bike riding.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. And you can look at whether they have bike paths or not in those countries.
How many of them actually have posted signs, because some don't.
The other causes one, what did we decide other causes was?
War, injuries.
Firearms
or other accident
causes.
I think it's
firearms. Like, accidental. Oh, it's firearms. That would be like suicide. Would that include suicides? Let me tell you that. Let me know, friends.
Accidents caused by firearms. I don't think
I don't know. It's unexpected deaths. Could be suicide. I don't know. That would be an interesting thing to figure out. It could also be hunting accidents. It's the Dick Cheney.
Dr. White, I have this is kind of a real life example, but maybe you can help us sort out right now with reporting methods. Perhaps that's what's causing the difference in these places. Maybe the United States has better methodology for recording their homicide data.
Right.
So in the United States, recently data has come out that Utah leads the nation in antidepressant use, and we also are the most depressed people in the nation. And there's a whole bunch of people, psychotherapists and things like that, are saying, no, actually, we're not more depressed. We just report things better, and we don't have as many people self-medicating. Right. So it's looking like, you know, we've got 10 homicides per 100,000, you know, here in Utah, that same type of thing, when in fact, we're just reporting the information better, and perhaps other states have more depression and more anti, but they're self-medicating, or
right.
they're not reporting or seeking help like we do here in Utah.
Good.
Is that a valid argument that they're making? I thought
sure.
it was. Sure.
I mean, it's a potentially valid argument.
Okay.
And so how would you begin to explore that argument? You would create a table like this.
Mm-hmm.
You would probably rank order in terms of number of depressed people per 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would look at, and then you'd have another variable about accuracy of reporting or quality
okay.
of recording, and you would probably have some sort of numerical rating of that. Sorry to say a qualitative rating, but now you know that none of them are qualitative, they're all nothing.
Yeah.
But that's exactly why I don't like the terms qualitative and quantitative. I mean, thoughtful and not thoughtful, I think, would be better terms sometimes. That just because you put a number on it doesn't make it right. And so you have to put a good number on it, and you have to be thoughtful about how you do that. And if you want to equate good numbers with qualitative research, then okay, as long as it's well done. But, you know, those numbers that get reported, as quantitative as they are, can be very bad data.
Okay. And the only other thing that kind of bothers me, I guess, about the data collection on this table is I feel a lot more comfortable making assumptions from the data if the years have been a range of years. So if they've taken data on unexpected deaths, and obviously you can't kind of help how countries report data, but if they have
right.
data for a 10-year period instead of just 1 year,
yeah.
because,
yeah.
for example, the homicides and injuries caused intentionally, data is including deaths by police. So if there was a riot in a country or something like
right.
that in 1 year and they killed 12 people in that riot, that would report, that would look like an anomaly on there. It wouldn't maybe
right.
in a 10-year period that wouldn't be the
sure.
same result.
So, yeah, I mean, or if you think of what happened in 9/11 on
right.
one day. I mean, that could skew things. So having more stable data.
Right.
Okay, so we had where's my last example? Here it is. Okay. Okay, so here's one more thing to do with the data.
Circling outliers.
Yeah, and so calling attention to certain points in the table. Now, again, that's a subjective decision on the researcher part. He's saying, this is what I want you to notice. So you've got an obligation to be thoughtful about what you call attention to. This is sort of beginning to combine now elements of a table and what we usually think of as a graph or a figure. But that's okay to blend those things. And what I hope you'll do in your papers too is that you're not supposed to just be giving me a warehouse full of information. You're supposed to help the reader understand what you think is most important about that information and why it led you to the conclusion that it did. Remember, the fourth attribute of a good integrated review is that there is an explicit link between the conclusions you're drawing and the data you've reported in your review. And so, now not only did they circle things or put boxes around things, they also separated them in terms of France and Austria have been separated from Germany, Belgium, Finland, Canada, US and Sweden, etc. So they've got five different groups that they say, now these are more alike within the group than between the groups. And if you look at, they've clumped them by total unexpected deaths. And so you've got France and Austria that are the two high ones. And what they're sort of implicitly saying there is, I don't think there's much of a difference between 75 and 78. And I don't think there's much of a difference between 56 and 66. Not as much of a difference between 56 and 66 as there is between 66 and 75. So those are the other kinds of things you might want to think about as you present data. Now, very few of you are going to have tables just like this, but I think there are some general principles here that get talked about in the Tuft manuscript that these examples point out. Now, let me show you one more example on a completely different topic. So we did a series of studies 20 years ago now, probably. Looking at the effects of early intervention programs for severely handicapped children. And they were all randomized studies in which we assigned children to a more intensive intervention or a less intensive intervention. The particular one I'm going to show you here was whether they got intervention for 3 days a week or 5 days a week. And these were all children that were mentally retarded children. And we collected a lot of data. So we had multiple child outcome measures, multiple parent measures every year. And so it led to data like this. Okay. So this is from the appendix. So this is year one data on all the various instruments that we collected information on. Okay. And then here's year two data, I think. And then here's your three data. So you got all that, right? I mean, so there's a lot of information there. But that's the kind of information that, you know, even though there is data there, and we've given you p-values and effect sizes, there's still too much information to process unless you spend a long time looking at it. Remember the example we did on the very first day of class where I said, here are reading and math scores for 40 kids, now tell me which they did better on, reading or math? I mean, this is the same sort of thing, but even worse. So the question becomes, how do you present all of that information in a way that communicates to readers what really happened in this study? So this is the idea we came up with. Now, it's a completely different format than you've ever seen. So it takes a second to understand what we're doing. But we're saying 3 days a week is on the left hand, 5 days a week is on the right hand. We're going to compute standardized mean difference effect size between the groups. If there's no difference between the groups, they'll fall right on the line. So there's absolutely no difference. They would all fall on the line. The numbers tell you whether it's the first post-test, the second post-test, or the third post-test that happened a year apart. They're circled if they're statistically significant at the 0.05 level. Okay. Now maybe it's just because, and then the big letters, like up here, are the averages for all the measures in that year. Okay. So if you take all of the child measures, no, those are both child and family measures. No, these are just the child measures on this chart. There is a separate chart for the family measure. And it says average child measures at the top. So the take-home message from this is that, boy, 3 days a week versus 5 days a week doesn't make much difference. Okay? I mean, there are some statistically significant ones, but there's a whole lot more that weren't statistically significant. And if you look at all of them in a multivariate sense, then they aren't statistically significant. Year one, little advantage for 5 days, but year two, little advantage for 3 days. Year three, a little advantage for 5 days. So it's kind of flip-flopping back and forth. And if you want the specific information, then it's in an appendix. But this is really giving it to you in a way that you can digest it. Okay, so that's your challenge now as you begin to try and process all the information you've been collecting from these articles you've been reading, is how to portray it in a way that the reader can understand what you're doing. Okay? Any questions? Any other comments about the Tuft article? We're about out of time. Okay. Go home and keep writing. Let me see, next week, you're going to read another lit piece, okay? Yeah. Lit review critique number 4. And so the rating form you should use for that is the one in which you assign it 100 points. 25 possible for problem statement, 10 for research questions, 40 for lit review, etc.
Thank you.
Katrina's allergic to class.
I'm allergic to everything when the rain comes.
All right, let's quit.